continuing with Henry Rishbeth on 3 August 78. So you heard, Shane had heard about Burke and Franklin's discovery.
That's right. I remember talking, Borsi talking about it, and Shane realized that his 18 megahertz survey with, about a 17 degree beam width at Hornsby could have observed this. And so he looked at those old records, and sure enough, there was the radiation. Now, as Borsi said to him, and I think this was fair, that, I mean, he couldn't be blamed for missing it at the time, because it was been a very tricky thing to pick up. It looked just like RF interference.
And he had such a broad
beam. Of course
beam.
It was, and it was a broad beam. But then when he started correlating it with the rotation period of the planet, that was when it began tumbling out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was the first person
That's
to
right.
think of this.
Mm.
And that looked very exciting. So then we... they then put up the 19.6 megahertz interferometer, which was just two antennas, I suppose, 100 or so meters apart, two small arrays, specifically designed to look at Jupiter, and Frank Gardner ran that.
I see.
And it operated for several months, possibly a year. It had some distinction that it was the only instrument to record the enormous solar flare of 1956 February 23.
I see.
It was a major solar event, and it just so happened that that was the all the solar things were out of
and they weren't even trying
yeah,
to
they weren't even it. Trying but but they recorded it.
Jupiter happened to be near.
However, so Frank Gardner and did more or less confirm the Jupiter work, and of course this was then several years later, and so the conditions on the planet changed.
Do you happen to remember whose idea it was about checking for rotation? This was something that
I would think it was Shane's own idea. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't swear to it whether Borsi thought of it or Shane.
Mm.
But anyway, Shane did it. I think that you could probably look at the paper on that one, because Shane was a very meticulous sort of person, and a very, very fine person to work for, and I've learnt a lot from him and so on, and I'm sure that if it was Borsi's or anyone else's idea, he would have said so.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that he was never the sort of person to claim things for himself, so mm-hmm. if there's nothing about it, I think you would take it that that it was his own idea.
He has died a couple of years ago, unfortunately.
Oh, long he died about 1960, soon after I left Australia.
Oh, I'm sorry, you're right. It was long ago, but in any case, I'm not able to talk to him.
So anyway,
is this what inspired you to this paper that you published in 1959?
Yes, it was indeed. At the time, we were, of course, thinking about mechanisms, and it seemed that although nobody there knew very much about plasma oscillations, or that there must be some kind of plasma phenomenon that was taking place. We didn't know much about the frequency spectrum or anything. In fact, there was a proposal that I wrote up to use the solar instruments at NAPTO the radio spectrographs,
mm-hmm.
and use the low frequency one, and with a new suitable aerial, and try and do the frequency scans of those bursts. And I actually wrote that up as a sort of lab report, but it failed on signal to noise. I mean, it just seemed that strong though the bursts were, that it was not possible to spectrum analyze with them with the DAPTO equipment, so we never did it.
But in hindsight, does that seem right? I think that's probably not
I'm
right.
I'm not sure. There were other factors involved. I think that one would be that my time was limited, and that I probably thought that it wasn't a good idea to fragment my own personal effort too much.
Yeah.
The solar group were perhaps heavily committed on other things. So I don't know. I can't say. I've never gone back to it and with the specific question of could we have done it with that equipment.
Well, that's trying to rewrite history, perhaps.
But on the other hand, I think that if it was gone into fairly carefully, and the excitement in the subject was
mm-hmm.
such was that if it had produced a reasonable chance of getting a useful result, I think Paul Wilde and Shane, the drive in that group was such, they would have done it.
So it,
I think it's... It, I think it was technical feasibility that we didn't go ahead. But it was an interesting exercise to work out. But
anyway, so you went to paper.
Well, the thing about that was then, if we therefore did not have the spectral information, but it seemed reasonable to inquire that could Jupiter have a plasma frequency or a gyro frequency or some other characteristic parameter in the tens of megahertz range?
Mm-hmm.
And we knew nothing then about the planet's magnetic field. I mean, that came decades later, of course. But
well, it came from the Jupiter observations eventually.
Yes, but it did. But however, so with my ionospheric background that I had gotten in my work with Radcliffe, both before and after my visit to Australia, then I did some very rough calculations which suggested that there could be plasma frequencies in the Jovian ionosphere of around about 20 megahertz, and I think this conclusion holds, even though the particular assumptions as to the chemistry and recombination and so on involved were almost certainly wrong.
Yeah.
I think I got the right answer for the wrong reason, but it was probably the first paper on a planetary ionosphere.
Mm-hmm.
At least it must have been one of the earliest.
So this was written after you got back to Cambridge then?
Yes.
And also, you had your thesis was half radio astronomy and half F-region work.
Yes. The point was that it was fairly clear that although I'd done quite a bit of work on these galactic H2 regions, that there was no blinding inspiration in them. And, and Radcliffe's impression was that, and I think correctly, that it did not amount to a PhD. And he was anxious to have someone working on F-region theory, and I was, I too was anxious to get back to that field, because from what I'd seen of it for a few months in 54, it was, I liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went back to that.
I see.
And it's been my work more or less.
You stayed there.
I stayed there.
Now, I have not been able to talk to Radcliffe himself. I'd like to ask you a question as to what influence do you see that he had as more or less as Ryle's boss in the success of Ryle's group, or is it mainly just that he stayed out of the picture and let Ryle do his thing, and that was the best?
I think he set it up and let him get on with it, and gave him the support, and that's just my impression.
Right.
I saw no other direct contact. I mean, the only contact I ever saw was on rare occasions when we had a literature discussions, you know, the Saturday morning literature discussions, which were a great feature of the Cavendish. And these were separate for the radio astronomy and ionosphere, because they had to be, for the field was so wide. And I think that on occasions, that if there were some interesting papers in the radio astronomy field that had strong ionospheric connections, that Radcliffe might come along and talk about them, but that's all I can say.
Okay, well, thank you very much. That ends the interview with Henry Rishbeth on 3 August 1978.